So this is coming out of work I've been doing with the Extinction Studies Working Group, just a small group of us, Debbie Birdrose, Tom Vandoren, and people like that. So we've been thinking about how humanities scholars in particular might respond to the sixth mass extinction event that's happening at the moment. So there's a lot of work in biology and things like this around the issues that are coming up with it, but how would you respond as humanities scholars? And some of that's been experimenting a little bit with writing styles and things. So my background's mainly doing work around issues to do with time. So I've been thinking particularly around temporality and extinctions. And that's led a lot to thinking about food, actually. So in the abstract, there's sort of this idea of how important time is and timing for being able to eat and what you can eat and what's around when you need to eat. So this is kind of an exploration of all those different kinds of ideas. So when I first wrote this paper, I was in Australia. It was 2 a.m, and I was racing to get something written for the conference the next day. The eeriness of the pre-dawn had me wondering about clocks, about what they were really. There I was in the purple blackness of a Sydney night, cold and hungry, listening to its inexorable ticking. Tick, tick, tick. Hurry up, hurry up, hurry up. You'll be late, you won't have any sleep, you don't have time. We had been talking about birdsong the day before, like we were yesterday, questioning then, as now, the idea that a bird's taste was built upon an underlying mechanical process. I fancied that maybe something about the clock song might also need revisiting, since there too we were told that clock time is a rigid mechanical process that is unaffected by context and seasons, to quote Barbara Adam. But maybe I wondered, maybe we haven't been listening to clocks attentively enough either. Maybe we've just been poring over their bones, clacking them together, clack, 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 and thinking that we know all there is to know about time and the rhythms that bind beings together. Our clocks promise that they can keep us coordinated, that if we plan sensibly, all will take place as it should, that we will continue to have peach-flavoured springs, a December of port and mince pies, chocolate Easters and sweet corn autumns. But in a time of climate change, extinctions, habitat loss and more, what if in a time like this, we have our hours muddled, our dates disoriented, our counting confused? What does time become when the relationships it used to enable have broken down? When flowers don't appear when pollinators arrive? Spring seems to call in the middle of winter, or when species are simply no longer there? So I sat there, holding the clock's bones in my hands, wondering how they might work differently. And as I sat there, the bones started growing flesh. I'm cold and I'm hungry, but my paper still needs writing. So I lie on the carpet, soaking up the radiant heat from the underfloor system and snack on almonds. I'm reading scientific articles, as precise and dry as ever. Despite the author's best intentions, I'm not captured by their long lines of scientific rationalism. Instead, the dark carpet in my room morphs into black sand. I am on Tortuguero Beach, on Costa Rica's Atlantic coast. In this place, the time is peak leatherback nesting season. A jaguar ventures out of the cover of trees. She is under the close eye of human researchers, tagged and tracked, part of halting the fast downward trend of jaguar populations across the Americas. Tonight she is hungry and she is seeking unusual prey, sea turtles. Until recently, she had not needed to hunt this well-protected quarry. The forest was large and held many options for her. She could take peccaries, monkeys, agouti, many different kinds of birds or fish. But the forest grew smaller and so do her choices. Then, if you'd asked her the time, she might have told you about following white-lipped peccaries from uplands to coastal forests to swamps as the wet season turned into the dry, or of hunting mornings and late afternoons when the peccaries were out foraging for their food, both predator and prey taking their time to rest during the midday heat. But with peccary numbers dwindling, she's become attentive to a new rhythm. This clock does not signal through the shifting sense of ripening fruits, but via the sound of bodies dragging themselves out of the ocean. Ever the opportunist, she has begun to forge new relationships of predator and prey. To do this, she has also had to forge a new time. She has noticed that the turtles arrive with the new moon and adjusts her sleep to coordinate with them. Synchrony is made flesh in her desire to sustain her own life. The beach now holding jaguar and turtle in a fraught and fragile shared moment. Usually she finds green turtles digging out their nests, but she is early, the time not quite yet peak green turtle nesting season. Tonight something huge and unexpected has hauled itself out of the water. Not looking very much at all like the others, she is still able to attack the leatherback's vulnerable flippers and neck. Perhaps next year she will show a cub how to take advantage of the unprotected flesh, who in her turn might bring cubs to feed on this becoming familiar prey. Created year after year, synchronies become a sequence through generational time, or at least they used to. Since the last great extinction event, the tangle and weave of embodied time that brings food and fed to each other has grown increasingly ornate and precise. But here in the midst of another such event, time is becoming threadbare. The forests, the peccaries, the jaguars, the leatherbacks, all are under threat. They will shift and adapt, seeking out gaps and openings that might remake the rhythms that support their lives. Like my clock, the new moon promises the jaguar that if she keeps to the right rhythms, all will take place as it should. But how many turtles will survive and return next year? How much habitat will she have left? And what, the authors ask, are conservationists to do when one endangered species starts eating another? Another article points out further complications arising in the aftermath of this new taste. Locals walking along the beach have found the fresh leatherback carcass. Not seeing the point in leaving it to rot, they ask the park managers if they can take it to eat. Unlike the jaguar, they draw on centuries-long histories of eating leatherback. But for the sake of continuing the turtle's millions of years inhabitation of this sea, their request is denied. In these times of extinction, a human encounter with a turtle is not supposed to be about food, but about tourism and research. The same time that presses the jaguar and the turtle into connection disconnects others. Nesting season closes public beaches for locals, but opens them for foreign visitors taking advantage of gaps in their own time to see the turtles. Time ends and time begins, but never in the same way for everyone. Journal articles are scattered all around me now, here on the warm carpet. I reach for one at random and am swept out even further, all the way to the other side of the Atlantic. With the time now jellyfish season, the leatherbacks have shifted from prey to predator. They have been searching out jellyfish blooms in the North Irish Sea. Leatherbacks draw on 110 million year-long sequences of relationships, knowing where to be and when in order to create the beneficial synchronies that make futures. Conservation scientists are slowly piecing together the multiple factors that each turtle attends to in order to be in the right place at the right time. Underlying search rules begin piling up. Ekman upwellings, chlorophyll A levels, sea surface temperatures, eddies, swells, choppiness, and currents. They've built their own clocks as surely as we've built ours. Once found, they settle into methodically eating their prey, the sheer abundance of jellyfish allowing them almost to graze. While the jaguar's body has not yet invented a way of getting into a large turtle's carapace, the leatherback's has had the time it needed to find solutions to its own problems. Jelly after jelly gets pulled into its spiny throat. Easy to get in, impossible to get out, they can eat their own body weight in a day. Coordinating even still, they move with their prey as the jellyfish rise to the surface at night and sink down during the day. Unlike the jaguar, however, the fear is not that the leatherback's prey are decreasing, but that they might be exploding exponentially. The human activities that have contributed to the swift reduction in leatherback populations might be perversely turning the oceans into a perfect habitat for jellyfish. Where once there were stories of fish being so abundant that during salmon runs, rivers might contain more fish than water, now jellyfish are shutting down tourist resorts, killing fish farms, and blocking intake valves for nuclear power plants. Clearing them from the Orit Rabin coal-fired power station in Israel in 2011 required diggers and shipping containers. As with fears of the rise of superweeds on land, abundance is not absent, but might be abruptly shifting form. Human fears don't always coincide with those of leatherbacks, though. Their nesting cycles are determined by the availability of prey. Only after meeting their own needs do they start storing away energy for the intensive work of egg production and travelling to nesting beaches. Increased jellyfish blooms might remake these cycles, and transform the rhythm of leatherbacks' lives. Being able to build their reserves, energy reserves more quickly could allow more frequent returns to nesting beaches and larger clutches. Oceans filled with the hauntings of the loss of over 90% of leatherback populations just might replenish themselves, even yet. Yet the ghosts refuse to be banished. I hear them quite close by, their steady tick that offers, on occasion, a sense of safety, of dependability and calculability, has been transposed into an eerie clattering. Time is not what it once was, and all around rhythms are shifting and transforming. Since, like the jaguars, leatherbacks have also developed a new taste, encountering a new form of prey in the form of plastics. We have a tentative date for when this new relationship might have first begun. An autopsy conducted in 1968 gives the first recorded instance of plastic being found in the animal's gastrointestinal tract. Since then, just over 35% of leatherback autopsies have revealed plastic in their guts, and of these, they are the likely cause of death in around 9% of cases. Plastic might only kill a few outright, but this new relationship adds another indeterminate cadence to the lives of leatherbacks. Trapped in their intestines, plastics slow the absorption of nutrients. The hope held out that an increase in jellyfish populations might foster increased nesting is now tempered by an opposing rhythm that is more certain to produce a decrease. Here, then, is a new impediment that must somehow be coordinated with, yet another fraught and fragile shared moment being created in a time of extinctions. How far into the future it will extend can't yet be said. As Alan Wiseman writes, plastics haven't been around long enough yet for us to know how long they're going to be around for. Ask why leatherbacks eat plastics, and the obvious response seems to be the floating bilious plastic bags have simply been mistaken for jellyfish. But ask when leatherbacks eat plastic, and the story becomes more complicated and more interesting. One suggestion from research done in the Gulf of Gascony is that as their jellyfish prey decreases, leatherbacks' intake of plastic increases. In an abundance of jellyfish, there is not much reason to risk trying this strange new variety of prey. But hunger shifts time, and once steady, predictable relationships give way to uncertain futures. Continued life depends on risk-taking, on changing and adapting. The jaguar knows this, and so too do leatherbacks. Would they be here today if their own ancestors hadn't took a risk and found a way of forging a beneficial relationship with toxin-laden jellyfish? By doing so, they were able to gift their descendants a niche coveted by few other creatures. Faced with their own new and unusual prey, the leatherback's body is again being pushed to find novel solutions. And so hungry and more open to forging new relationships, the leatherback takes a chance and bites.